You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Okay, good morning, everybody, and thank you for coming at what to Washington is a relatively early hour, but I'm glad to see all of you here. Today is, we will talk about the peace process and where is it going from here. As we all know, the bilateral talks have started in September and then ended shortly after. There are very few people who are optimistic that these talks will lead to a breakthrough. But this will be the subject of the talk of our speaker today, to see what hope do we have for these talks and what alternative strategies exist in case these talks do indeed fail. You all know Khalil. He needs no introduction. Let me just say that I met Khalil for the first time in 1995 when I was ambassador to Israel, and he invited me to speak at his center. And since then, I truly came to rely on Khalil's judgment, on Khalil's analysis of the situation. I don't think there are many Palestinians who are more equipped than Khalil in terms of his insights, his perceptions, his knowledge of Palestinian society as well as the Arab-Israeli conflict, the polls that he has conducted over the years, which have become, I think, a reference point for many analysts of the conflict in terms of having the finger on the pulse of the Palestinian street and in telling us what Palestinians are thinking of at any particular point in time. I have the highest respect for Khalil's abilities, and I think, as always, he will give us a very provocative and insightful lecture. So, Khalil, without further ado, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Marwan. Very, very kind introduction. I don't deserve most of what he said. Maybe a little bit. Most of it. It's exaggeration.
Not at all.
As you can see from the title of my talk, it says without the peace process. So my assumption is the peace process most likely will not be resumed the way we know it, or that if resumed, it will not survive the challenges that we have seen and likely to see in the months ahead. And so my talk will essentially focus on describing what, in this case, Palestinians will be doing. And why they will find themselves in a situation where they would have to embrace the new approach that they will take, and I'll say something perhaps about what might then follow, although I myself not sure exactly what might follow. And this is not really an attempt to predict what might happen, as it is a kind of attempt to brainstorm about what are the dynamics involved and where, if we know that today, what is it that we might do differently than what we seem to be doing at this time? I start by arguing that, unlike previous rounds of negotiations between Palestinians and Israelis, the Palestinian leadership is now seriously considering, some would say actually already embarking on alternative strategies and options. If in the case negotiations do not restart or start and fail. And I think in their mind, this is something that they can start right away. But most likely, I think they understand that this process will take some time and maybe by the end of the year, this would be something that they would really have to, not this year, next year, that they would really have to start doing. The reason that they are thinking seriously about this, and this is something that has happened, that has not happened before. I don't believe that this is has been part of the Palestinian thinking at the time of Camp David in 2000. And I have absolutely no doubt that there was no Palestinian sort of plan B at the time of Camp David or immediately after that. And of course, this was not also the case in the negotiations after in the negotiations between Abu Mazen and Olmert. The reason that the Palestinian leadership is considering its options now is because it wants to avoid certain options. And that is really important. And I'll come to this point if I do get around this. And I'll say something about the implications of having to do something, not because you think it's a great idea, but because you really don't want to do the other thing. So what is the other thing? I think the PIA wishes to avoid a repeat of what happened after the collapse of Camp David in 2000. That is the eruption of violence at the moment someone provides a match. I think Abbas in particular, the most Palestinians, but not everyone in Fatah's leadership, but no doubt Abbas is convinced that violence, if it erupts, would be fatal, and the PIA must do its utmost to prevent it. He's convinced that only Israel and Hamas will benefit from such violence, just as they did, let me rephrase, Israel's right and Palestinian right, Hamas and the Likud, would be the beneficiary of such violence, just as they were the beneficiaries of the violence of the Second Intifada. That is Abbas's thinking. So for now, while he has public opinion, he's able to publicly articulate that view that there should be no violence. Under no circumstances will he tolerate it. But he also wants to avoid another scenario, a situation in which the failure of negotiations, along with his insistence that there should be no violence, that this would force him to swallow a deal with Hamas from a position of weakness. In this, he's obviously going against the wishes of the majority of the Palestinian public, so he certainly cannot say that publicly. He can publicly denounce violence, but he is not going to say anything publicly about what I think he thinks, which is there is no room for reconciliation with Hamas. So the solution is to pay lip service to reconciliation. The solution is to go to Damascus, as he is doing right now, sending Azam al-Ahmad and others to negotiate with Hamas leadership in Damascus. Of course, if Hamas agrees to reunification, not reconciliation, but reunification, he would go for it. But I think as much as Abu Mazen does not have incentives to reconcile Hamas too, does not have any, I believe, at the moment, serious incentives to reconcile, let alone, of course, allow reunification under Abu Mazen's leadership. I'll come to this question later as well. So both the determination to prevent the eruption of violence and the desire to avoid reconciliation with Hamas. Now there is something he wants to maintain. He wants to prevent these two things, but he wants to maintain state building. And one of the critical elements of state building is security coordination and cooperation with the Israeli security forces. But if he does continue in an environment of failed peace process, if he does continue with security coordination and cooperation, he will lose all the confidence of the Palestinian public, and the security services will be seen as collaborators, and so he cannot allow that. So he has these three interests: no violence, no reconciliation with Hamas, continued security coordination with the Israelis, and he has to create an environment whereby he is able to pursue these three goals, even though there is no peace process. The alternative is a strategy, a four-point strategy that I'll come to in a minute. And this strategy then provides the context for him for doing these three things: prevent violence, security coordination, and no reconciliation with Hamas. So my talk is really about exploring these four options, four components of the strategy he has, and to talk about the triggers, why these in particular. But before I really, really depress you, as I know I will, let me then say something positive first. And I do believe in that very, very strongly, in the positive things I will be saying. And you'll probably agree with me in many of the things that I will say. There are many, many reasons. I can list 10. Well, I'm not going to have time to list all the 10, but I'll list some of them that make the current environment, certainly on the Palestinian side, but also on the Israeli side, the best time to lead towards ending the conflict. I don't think we have ever been, not at Camp David, certainly not at Camp David, and certainly not in 2008, not yet. In 2008, we were actually making significant progress in the direction of things that I will describe. But we have never been in a situation where we are now. If someone wants to lead, this is really an opportunity to lead. At the U.S., this is number one, the U.S. and Arab level, there is greater interest in moving forward than at any time before, certainly compared to where we were in 2000. When the process started in the last 6 months of the administration, when the Arabs were deliberately excluded from the process of consultation, and when there was no quartet, there was no Arab peace initiative, and when there was no American interest in improving American-Arab relations, given the threats that have emerged during the last decade. So there is no doubt that there is an interest in all among all those actors to move forward, much greater than it was in 2000. Palestinian public institutions, in my view, are much better than they were in 2000, before the eruption of the Intifada, both in the West Bank and in Gaza, under Hamas, and as well as under Fayyad. In the three most important areas of reducing corruption, ensuring financial accountability and transparency, enforcing law and order, this current situation on the Palestinian side is unprecedented. The third reason why things are good: Palestinian and Israeli public support for compromise today is much stronger than it has been at any time before, certainly much higher than it was in 2000. 2005 was a very good year for public support for compromise. that came immediately after Arafat died, etc. And we are today trying to get back to that period, but I think this is more an outcome of optimism, and if that optimism can be restored, then we will see greater, even greater support for compromise than we see today. Fourth, the Fatah, the nationalist movement in 2000 was totally split, young guard, old guard. The level of fragmentation was great. This, by the way, was also true in 2008. The institutions of the nationalist Fatah Central Committee, Fatah Revolutionary Council, and by extension, the PLO Executive Committee, these are the three institutions that will first make any decisions about the peace process. They were totally irrelevant, and no Palestinian leader could count on them to provide him with legitimacy. Today's institutions are different. They're real. There is a much greater accountability in these institutions. Fatah still has tremendous amount of problems, but it's certainly in a much better position now than it was before. In Israel, you have let's put aside the real problem, which I think is in the prime minister and his coalition. If the prime minister decides that he wants to pursue a peace deal, he can count on the Israeli center, on the Israeli left, and on the Israeli Arabs in the Knesset to support him. I think this is something that certainly prevailed as well during the Begin's period, when he made peace with Egypt. And if Netanyahu decides he wants to go forward, there is no doubt in my mind that he will have the necessary support he needs in the Israeli Knesset, certainly not in this coalition, but the Knesset itself is a much more hospitable environment for him. Sixth, Hamas, which opposes the two-state solution, has lost a considerable amount of its credibility as a result of its violent takeover of Gaza. In doing so, the takeover of Gaza destroyed the basis for any potential alliance between Fatah and Hamas along the lines of what happened during the Second Intifada, that is, on the question of violence, on the question of rejecting any possible deal along the lines of the two-state solution. The balance of power has now shifted against Hamas. It has not yet shifted in favor of Fatah, which, of course, is a considerable matter to deal with for Fatah. But Fatah does have an opportunity to capitalize on it did not have before the Hamas takeover, certainly. This is particularly true with regard to public expectations for unification, reunification, and for ending the Gaza siege in case Hamas, when that is in terms of public perception about these issues, the siege and the reunification. Half of the Palestinian public believes Hamas is bad news for reunification. Only a quarter of the public believes Fatah is bad news for reunification. That leaves a gap of a quarter of the Palestinians who believe Fatah is good, Hamas is bad, for something that is of top priority for the public. And when it comes for ending the siege, the gap is actually 50%, not 25%. So, of course, these two values, ending the siege and reunification, are two of the top four, the other two being economic condition, environment, and ending occupation. So if you have these four values, two of these, Fatah has a much better position vis-a-vis Hamas. Seven, Abbas. Abbas, in my view, is the ideal Palestinian leader to make to reach an end of conflict deal with Israel, compared to all Palestinians, not just compared to Arafat, but all Palestinian leaders in the last century, starting from Haj Amin Husseini through Shukairi, we never had a leader who is committed to the two-state solution. He's a pragmatist, not an ideologue. He strongly opposes violence, not just in words, but also in deed. He's fighting Hamas, trying to push it to accept a two-state solution. And I think if you put all this combination together, I challenge anyone to find a Palestinian leader who can do better. Eighth, the level of peace and quiet and that has resulted from the level of security coordination and cooperation between Palestinians and Israelis is unprecedented. I think I said this earlier. 2 days ago, the Israelis said they now have almost zero names in the list of wanted Palestinians. These are the Palestinian fugitives, Israelis consider them, who are wanted in the West Bank. And so the Israelis have really no reason to stay in areas, populated areas in the West Bank, given the security coordination that exists and given the fact that they themselves say they have very little to do. Let me just say one final thing about this. If we look at in 2001, Arafat was asked to go to Camp David. He said, hey, wait a minute. This is still a need for further processing. We need to negotiate. We haven't opened that. We haven't opened this. There's nothing that's been discussed about Jerusalem. And so he wanted more time to negotiate bilaterally with the Israelis. Now, the Palestinians say to the Americans, negotiate what? We've negotiated everything. It's time for decisions. That is a complete... And why do they say that? Because they think the gaps that are remaining between their position and that of previous Israeli governments are small. So there is, at least on the Palestinian side, certainly not on this Israeli government side, but on the Palestinian side, there is a perception that it is time to make tough choices. It's not really time. We have already negotiated anything that requires detailed negotiations, whether it is Jerusalem or refugees or anything else. Three days ago, in a speech Abbasin gave in the Gulf, he used a term to refer to his talks with Olmert. He said, we killed every single detail that is out there in our talks. He said, 8 months of extensive talks, we finished everything. We haven't reached agreement on everything, he said, but we finished negotiations, and it's really just time to make decisions. Okay, so I just say all of this because when I depress you, you will... You know, you have something to fall back on. The alternative strategy is not something that any Palestinian leader can now sort of embrace and say, oh, yes, this is it. This, I believe, is a project under construction. This is something that is evolving. And... every time Abu Mazen opens his mouth and talks about it, he comes up with something new. Every time Saab talks about it, so they are all in sort of thinking and rethinking about all this. It takes the development of this process of finding an alternative, takes as a point of departure two assumptions. One that says progress is not feasible with the Netanyahu coalition, and the U.S. will not use leverage against Israel. That's assumption number one. Assumption number two, without leading, the PLO will find its hands tied with gradual outbreak of violence, end of security coordination of the state and the process of state building, and a forced reconciliation with Hamas from a point of weakness. So that is these are the two assumptions that are pushing the overall assumptions that are pushing the search, the process of search. There are four components of this strategy that are being looked at. One is Arabization. It's not the Arabization that Marwan is calling for, but it actually gets very close to what Marwan wants. It means Abbas wants to take and is taking his case to the Arab states, not Arab Street. He's trying to transform Palestinian positions into Arab positions, thereby giving Palestinian demands and positions an Arab face. This in turn helps, this is the trigger for this, it helps in confronting the U.S. administration and reduces Obama's room for maneuver vis-a-vis the Palestinians. Abbas has another motivation. He seeks Arab legitimacy to cover his own lack of legitimacy. And yet there is a third reason. He wants to build an alliance with the Arab states against Hamas. For that, he is willing to say to Hamas, I'm your son. My decisions are your decisions. Make them for me. The second component is internationalization. He takes the case. This is not instead of. This is in addition to. He takes the case now that it has been packaged into an Arab case to various international forums, the Quartet, the United Nations Security Council. This involves graduation from the demand that the U.S. and the Quartet puts its own vision and bridging proposals to asking the U.N. Security Council for a vote on Israeli settlements, on Palestinian state, capital, borders, and so on and so forth. This comes as a response to growing, to Palestinian perception of a growing international support for Palestinian statehood, and the fact that the Palestinian public is a lot more willing to accept compromises coming from international forums than compromises coming from bilateral negotiations. There is tremendous public support for this, by the way. More than three quarters of the Palestinians support these ideas. The third element in the strategy is what one can call unilateralism. This is the essence of the Fayyad plan, or this is Plan B in the Fayyad plan. It has a two-year deadline. It ends in August of 2011. What exactly it will entail when the two-year deadline is over is not yet clear. There is a lot of debate. Abu Mazen is still opposed to a unilateral declaration, but a combination of Arab international and unilateral measure might be something that he will come around to support. There is public support for that, so he can count on the public to support him. And Fayyad will probably push for that. The alternative to Fayyad is to resign. If he doesn't see some sort of a process underway after the end of the two-year period, he has to resign. I don't think he wants to resign. So I think he will push for unilateralism. Finally, the fourth element is what I would call a global campaign to delegitimize occupation. Not to delegitimize Israel, but to delegitimize. I think the Palestinian leadership will be careful to avoid things that would be seen as siding with attempts to delegitimize Israel. The idea is to delegitimize Israeli policies, occupation policies. This is and this element, in fact, is a lot more de facto. This doesn't really involve making formal decisions on this matter. It is a diffused, highly decentralized process. In fact, at times it is contradictory. Some of the things they will be doing will be contradicting some other things they will be doing here. This one is therefore an attempt to try and take advantage of the favorable shifts in the international street and mobilize international public opinion to channel Palestinian demands for resistance towards more nonviolent, passive kind of resistance. It uses and it will be using tools of legal and judicial forums, boycotts, divestment, nonviolent resistance, such as in Belayin, Alin, Sheikh Jarrah, Silwan, etc. Promotion of, this is the in part the contradiction, of the one-state solution, alternative, because that also helps in delegitimizing occupation. mobilization of public opinion to free Gaza, and this is also contradictory because this could help Hamas. Some elements in what I've just said are supported not because they help Palestinians, but because they hurt Israelis. The message, or the messages, the messaging, if you wish, will include and will focus on things along the lines of Israeli occupation is building a system of apartheid. Israeli occupation forces are committing war crimes, including building of illegal settlements, which violate international law. Israeli blockade measures are destroying Gaza's economy and causing a humanitarian disaster. Israeli systemic Judaization of Arab East Jerusalem means legal institutional discrimination against Palestinian residents in the city to force them to replace them with Jews, etc. That these are the kind of messages that will emanate from and are emanating from this campaign. These are the four elements. So what is... let me go back to the triggers of this strategy. Trigger number one is the perception, Palestinian perception, leadership's perception of what is happening in Israel. In Palestinian eyes, this is the first time in the history of their permanent negotiations with Israel that they have to negotiate with a right-wing government. It never happened before. What are the implications of negotiating with this government? Well, it will make impossible demands, Palestinians believe, or harden positions that have been taken by Israeli leaders in previous negotiations. It is in this light, by the way, that Palestinians see the demand for long-term Israeli military presence in the Jordan Valley. This is also in this the same kind of context in which Palestinians see the demand for the recognition of the Jewish nature of the state. This is also the same frame in which they see the idea of Avigdor Lieberman of demographic exchange. The last two elements, the demographic exchange, but more so the demand for recognition of the Jewish nature of the state, in Abu Mazen's eyes, basically does something that violates the spirit of Oslo, because Oslo sought to sort of neutralize the Israeli Arabs, take them out of the picture of negotiations. They're Israelis, it's over. Now he has to consider not only the views of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, not only Palestinians in the diaspora, but Israeli Arabs. Because now, if he's to recognize the Jewish nature of the state, he has to worry about Israeli Arabs, and he has to worry. And so he thinks it brings Israeli Arabs into the negotiating forum, something he thought he has already been addressed. The second reason is that this is the first time that a government in Israel a right-wing government that wants to negotiate, but it says it will not sign agreements. There will be a different coalition for signing agreements, one to negotiate and one to sign agreements. Well, implication for Palestinians is that while negotiations are underway, this Israeli coalition, this Israeli government, if left unchallenged, would greatly expand the settlement project to new levels to appease right-wing partners in coalition so that they, the right-wingers, would tolerate the mere fact that negotiations are underway. This conclusion led the Palestinians to insist on the demand for a comprehensive settlement freeze, even when Obama himself abandoned this demand. It reflected this profound distrust in Netanyahu and his right-wing partners, leading to the conclusion that nothing is lost anyway by insisting on the freeze, as it is believed that negotiations will be futile anyway and will occur under conditions in which Netanyahu seeks to do his utmost to create further facts on the ground. And it is in this context, therefore, that the issue of the security coordination becomes very, very vulnerable, as Palestinians will simply see such cooperation as collaboration, will make it difficult to maintain it. And why does Abu Mazen want to maintain it? Well, it is, of course, he wants to maintain it in case there is really an opportunity for negotiations. So that has to be there, obviously. But even if there is no negotiations, this is perceived as a critical for the success of the alternative strategy. Without security coordination, the Israelis might then portray the Palestinian position as abandoning the whole process and putting the blame on the Palestinians. It is very critical for the success of state building. It actually protects the process of state building. As long as there is security coordination, cooperation, Palestinian state building can continue, and that is certainly a major goal of the strategy. It's also critical for continued U.S. support. Even if the U.S. may not support the alternative strategy, and there is very good reason to believe the Palestinian leadership believes the U.S. will not support the alternative strategy. Nonetheless, security coordination is important to keep the U.S. happy and to keep donor money coming. And finally, it's very important for the continuation of the fight against Hamas. If security coordination and cooperation fails, then Hamas's strength might be rebuilt. On the Israeli side, finally, and again, this is a very important element in the Palestinian calculus, Palestinians believe, the leadership believes, that Israelis do not feel the pressure to end occupation. Life is good for Israelis, and quiet is maintained by Palestinians. The implication is that failure in negotiations is not too risky at all for Netanyahu. He can afford it. He can actually win elections by ensuring there is no progress in negotiations. But it is too risky for Abbas. It is too risky because he has to, if he doesn't, then he has to negotiate with Hamas, which is waiting for him to fail. And because he has lost legitimacy, his term has ended, and because Fatah has lost elections, certainly, and Fatah is still having serious difficulties at the leadership level, finding alternatives to Abu Mazen. And, of course, if negotiations fail, there is fear that he will then abandon the whole thing and go home, and Fatah will be left with no leaders. And so for all these reasons, the risks for Fatah and for Abbas and for Fayyar, of course, are great, but Palestinians believe there is no risk for Netanyahu. And so that is, these are the three major triggers for the Palestinian search for alternatives. On the U.S., there has been, during the last few months, almost total, I would say, collapse. I mean, it has been gradual. The administration first lost the public, but it has now lost the leadership. The loss of confidence with the administration, and that the administration has simply will simply not do what is required, which is to use leverage to pressure the government of Israel to do the right thing, rather than work with the limits set by the current coalition, which is a right-wing coalition. And Palestinians believe they have seen this coming, first abandoning the demand for comprehensive settlement freeze, then abandoning the proximity talks in favor of direct talks, even though nothing has changed to change things, and there was no prior consultation with the Palestinians on this. And thirdly, because the Americans failed during the proximity talks to get the Israelis to give them anything, to negotiate anything. So the whole thing was a game for the Israelis. Palestinians believe in the administration, simply accepted it, tolerated it, and therefore Palestinians don't believe this is going to go anywhere. Then there are the domestic triggers. The domestic triggers are, I believe, a lot more important than the American or even the Israeli triggers. There is the issue of the legitimacy of the Palestinian leadership, the term ended. When you can't buy legitimacy via elections, and you can't buy it via violence, allowing violence. Arafat was very clever in using violence to buy his own legitimacy when he lost his electoral legitimacy, and Abu Mazen doesn't want to do that. There is a third way, of course, to reconcile with Hamas. Hamas is happy with you, so you have some legitimacy, and he doesn't want to do any of those. And he doesn't want to terminate security coordination, so you have to come up with a source of legitimacy for why you're there. And so the search is essentially domestic. That desire to have some sort of legitimacy, some source of legitimacy, is very strong. The second is because even though Abu Mazen might not be very assertive, Fatah today is a lot more assertive. The young guard control the institutions of Fatah, and they remember what happened to him when he decided to postpone the vote on the Goldstone report. He was vilified by Fatah, by his own colleagues. He was left out there in the cold. No one would say a good word to him. He discovered the limits. He's not only not no Arafat when it comes to leading Fatah, but the institutions that Arafat had to work with were subservient to him. They did whatever he wanted. They rubber stamped what he wanted. They weren't there to begin with. They were irrelevant. The institutions of Fatah that Abu Mazen needs to deal with are different institutions, and they are thinking about what needs to be done, and they are there to stay. It's not like Abu Mazen can go home. They have a battle, and they want to win it for public hearts and minds of Palestinians. So they have to come up with alternative strategies. And of course, the third domestic source is the competition with Hamas. There's a great deal of public demand for reconciliation, expectation that if negotiations fail or are not resumed, Fatah must be the one to reach out to Hamas because it's the one that has failed. You had alternatives, they failed, now come back and give Hamas all the concessions Hamas needs in order to have unification. He knows that. But he doesn't want to have reconciliation. This is the point that I said I'll talk a little bit more about it. In fact, I believe reconciliation poses a threat to his top priorities. It is the top priority. The reconciliation is certainly the top priority of the public, but it's not an urgent priority for the public. And that gives Abbas and Hamas, by the way, the room to maneuver. Given the fact that the reason it's not urgent is due to the fact that no vital interests, socioeconomic vital interests, are at stake as a result of the split. Because the split was a de facto split to begin with because of the Israeli policies. The only serious economic interests are those of Munib al-Masri. And he is working his ass off to get reconciliation achieved. And one reason he's doing it is because the Israelis won't allow him to actually pursue any business interests in Gaza. And so the only way he can do that is by reconciliation, in part. I must not be too hard on Munib. Hamas's two top priorities are self-preservation by maintaining security control over Gaza, and secondly, to seek the independence of Gaza under its control. In the meanwhile, it can wait while Hamas goes, while Fatah goes it alone, fail in the negotiations, and of course it believes that the public, while it wants reconciliation, can be given the impression that reconciliation is being searched for. And if Hamas can establish an independent entity in Gaza, the crossings with Egypt opened, the siege is lifted, and so on, then unity can come later when the West Bank is also free. That is Hamas, I believe, Hamas's the thinking of the mainstream among Hamas leadership, particularly in Gaza. Fatah's two top priorities are, well, similarly like Hamas, first, self-preservation by maintaining security control over the West Bank, and secondly, working with Israel and the international community on ending occupation and building a Palestinian state. In the meanwhile, Fatah also looks at what Hamas is doing, and they think Hamas is digging deeper and deeper in the mess of Gaza and is losing credibility, and as indeed Hamas is losing. And of course can use the misery in Gaza in the campaign to delegitimize occupation, and of course can watch as Hamas loses Arab support and credibility and so on. So these are two the two groups that are supposed to reconcile, and these are their interests. And if there is going to be reconciliation, the costs are tremendous for both Fatah and Hamas. Fatah would lose the ability to maneuver with Israel, with the U.S., and lose public and perhaps donor support. And, of course, it would have to share power with Hamas, and it doesn't want to do that, at least not now. Once there is a peace agreement, maybe. And I think by the mere fact that it might reach a peace agreement could be an incentive for Fatah to share power with Hamas. Hamas similarly loses the ability to gain financial and political support from allies by reconciliation, from allies in Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah. It loses exclusive control over Gaza, and it loses the opportunity to impose Islamization of society, something it is trying to do in Gaza today. And, of course, it realizes that even under the best of circumstances, reconciliation simply means it becomes a junior partner to Fatah, even though it won the elections. And, of course, it fears the next elections because now it can say it has legitimacy because it won the last elections. If new elections are held, well, Hamas's assessment is that it will lose the elections. In that case, it will lose legitimacy. Legitimacy it believes it now has. So, will this succeed? Will this alternative strategy succeed? My view, it will not. It will not because, in part, this strategy is not being sought because it's an excellent strategy, but it's being sought in order to avoid alternative strategies or options. And Palestinians who tell us, overwhelming majority, more than three quarters, tell us, yes, go to the Security Council. That same overwhelming majority believes the U.S. will veto anything that comes to the UN Security Council. So Palestinians are supporting things they know beforehand they will not work. So what happens if they don't work? In my view, then, this whole thing will begin to unravel. This whole strategy will begin to unravel, and we will go back to a situation where violence becomes the de facto alternative. And all the goals that Fatah now considers important will no longer be feasible, and it will be forced to begin to deal with this alternative. It will terminate security coordination. It will seek reconciliation with Hamas under Hamas's conditions, and it will, in my view, tolerate violence. And is there anything that can be done to prevent us from moving this path? Can we now do something to prevent this from happening? I don't know.
Well, thank you very much, Khalil, for this comprehensive, if sobering, tour de force of the situation. We have about 35 minutes for questions and answers. I will suggest that we take a group of questions at a time so we can have as many questions as possible. And if you can please identify yourself before asking the question. Sir.
Hello, my name is Trond Botnen from Oslo, currently working for the International Center for Nonviolent Conflict here in D.C. Thank you very much for an excellent presentation, and I agree with very much of what you're saying. And last week I attended a meeting with Saar Barakat at the Wilson Center, where the American dialogue partner of his, Aaron David Miller, was very clear on that the U.S. was probably going to veto any unilateral declaration from the side of Palestine. So my question is sort of, come August next year, it's likely that the negotiations will have failed. It's likely the U.S. will have told Abbas that they will veto a unilateral declaration. What are then the options? You mentioned as the fourth pillar of the current strategy, the delegitimization of the occupation, the international BDS campaign, the nonviolent resistance in the West Bank. And it was noticeable that the British Foreign Minister, William Hague, met with local activists just a couple of days ago. I think that the one thing the Israelis are most afraid of is the specter of the one-state solution with the demographic changes. So my question is then, what would it be a feasible strategy, if all else fails, to focus more exclusively on a nonviolent resistance in the West Bank, an international BDS campaign, not demanding an independent state, but demanding democratic rights, and framing it as an anti-apartheid campaign, thereby raising the specter of international support for the one-state solution in order to present a two-state solution as a negotiated alternative later on? So do you see, what do you see as the strengths and weaknesses with such a strategy, and do you think it would be feasible, or would the public pressure for violence undermine such a strictly nonviolent strategy? Thank you.
Okay. Any questions, please?
I'm Diane Perlman with the Institute on Conflict Analysis and Resolution at George Mason, ICAR. I'm wondering if there's any... a lot of the approaches are like political compromise pressure, and it seems to me in general there's a lack of basic knowledge of the whole field of conflict analysis and resolution and strategies, techniques for analyzing the underlying conflict, dealing with basic human needs, legitimate goals, something I think of in a way as like political therapy. And a lot of the approaches are pushing for things that might have the opposite effect or provoke reactions, resistance, and there are more sophisticated strategies for sort of calming things and addressing that. And so could you speak to, is there any input from that dimension or openness to it?
Okay, Saeed.
My name is Saeed Erekat from Al Quds Daily Newspaper. Khalil, I want to ask you a question I asked you 8 years ago, next door, okay. While Arafat was besieged at the time. Why is it not time for this Palestinian Authority to really dissolve itself and shut out the light and just go home? Because what we have seen since then, in the last 8 years, is more land that is being expropriated. The Palestinian situation has not improved. And in fact, they are the biggest cover for the legitimizing the occupation. Thank you.
One more question before we give Khalil the chance, please.
Kyler Cronmiller from the State Department. I'm interested in some of the comments that you made about Fatah in particular. You say that it's less fragmented now than it was previously, and I'd like you to, if you have a chance, to talk a little bit about how and why you see it that way. And you also said that the young leaders or younger leaders control the institutions, and you cited Goldstone as an example. But how do you reconcile that with the Revolutionary Council's vote against Abbas going to direct talks and his decision to move forward anyway?
Okay. Khalil?
The two strategies that the Palestinian leadership will not embrace, although there are certain benefits that the leadership sees in them, are these two, the one Said asked about and the one our friend from Norway asked about. The one-state solution is not, in my view, going to be to become the motto of Palestinians. The reason for that is very simple. Unlike Israeli Arabs, who have made the transformation of accepting to live in the state of Israel and are demanding equal rights, Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza remain highly nationalistic in their attitudes, and they want sovereignty and independence. And they will not accept a one-state solution. Even if when we tell them, you know, they will have equal rights, and the state is not going to, this will be a state for both Palestinians, Palestinian Arabs and Israeli Jews, and nothing moves the public on this, and certainly the leaders of this process, Fatah, is even more nationalistic than the public at large, and in my view, this issue will not be the one that they will capitalize on, except in using it tactically to delegitimize occupation. That, I think, is something they will welcome, and from time to time, we will hear some of the leaders use that issue in order to sort of raise the cost for the Israelis. Similarly, with dissolving the Palestinian Authority. The clearest, Abu Mazen and Fayyad both have been absolutely clear. This is simply out of the question. This has never been considered, will never be considered. There is no thinking whatsoever of dissolving the Palestinian Authority. The overwhelming majority of the public says no. More than three quarters of the public says no to the one-state solution and no to dissolving the Palestinian Authority. But in his last speech that I read for Abu Mazen, he ended the speech by saying, well, the question that I raised earlier, what happens if this alternative strategy doesn't work? No one asked him the question. He actually had a speech, which I haven't heard it from him, but I read it, and I think it was prepared remarks. This was not something that he said just this on the spur of the moment. He said, if it all fails, all this alternative strategy fails, we, the Palestinians, will have the last word. And what was the last word? We will take Oslo back to the Israelis. We will say, you know, this is something we've agreed to do, but it's not working. Take it. We're no longer committed to it. We will abandon our obligations under Oslo. I don't know whether this is something that came out of consultation. There was something that came out a week or 10 days before that in which some of the Palestinian leaders hinted to that effect. which might mean there has been some sort of discussion. However, as I said earlier, I think this is a project under construction, and Palestinian leaders are simply struggling with this issue. For Saeed, when you have about 170,000 people in the public sector, that's 170,000 families, and consider the budget of the Palestinian Authority, and that will disappear. And well, there are people who are more people who are interested in in keeping the PA than in destroying it. And of course, it also goes against the thinking of state building. Palestinian First Intifada was about state building. It's about denying the legitimacy of the Israeli civil administration, passive resistance, and building alternative institutions to govern Palestinians. And now you're asking them to abandon all of that. I don't believe it will happen as a matter of policy. It could happen as a matter of fact. It could happen as an unintended outcome of things, simply as the case might be with the one-state solution, that without anyone deliberately seeking it, because all the other options have failed, that sort of forces itself on everybody. And they actually work together, these two options. You dissolve the PA on de facto basis, and you find yourself in a path that leads to the one-state solution. But it's, in my view, it is not part of this strategy that is now being deliberately sought by the Palestinian leadership. The conflict resolution ideas and concepts you're looking at, for Palestinian leadership, I think this is what they have been trying to do during the last 17 years, and the perception is it has failed, and Palestinians do not blame themselves for the failure. They blame somebody else, and I think they've reached the conclusion that bilateral negotiations with this Israeli government, at least, is not going to lead anywhere. That is something that they really strongly believes, that the majority believes in. And so diplomacy is in fact a kind of bad word for them. Well, Palestinians think this alternative strategy is part of that larger conflict resolution kind of process, that it forces costs on the Israelis, that conflict management or conflict resolution both require raising the costs, and that Israelis now have it all good, peace and quiet, security cooperation, no pressure, and that there is a need to increase the pressure, and it's not going to come through violence and so on. So, on Fatah, Abu Mazen has one extremely critical asset. There is no number two in Fatah. And without him, Fatah is lost in terms of leadership. The Central Committee, which is controlled by the Young Guard, is not controlled by a single Young Guard. It's controlled by several. And they still don't have one person who can lead in the absence of Abu Mazen. For this reason, they will challenge Abu Mazen as much as they can for as long as they can. But if Abu Mazen is determined, that is part of his power. If he is determined and if he pushes, he can actually get things done. So even though I've said something that might have sort of framed him as a weak leader, if Abu Mazen decides to lead and make tough decisions, Fatah will have no choice but to follow. If what he is proposing is not something that is a non-starter, particularly for the public at large. And yes, I said the fragmentation has been reduced significantly, and I think that is something good for Fatah. Still, there is still remaining issues that Abu Mazen has failed to address, even after he managed to hold the 6th Congress for Fatah. He is not very good with organization. He is not very good in building alternative leadership. And these are things that he really hasn't put a lot of effort in. And Fatah remains, therefore, dependent on him to a large extent. Maybe that is part of the reason why he isn't doing much of that.
Okay. Second batch. Marina.
Thank you very much. Thank you for a very good talk. I have two questions. One is really a follow-up to one of your previous answers, because if, in fact, Abbas has talked in what you said was probably a prepared speech and not about the possibility of taking Oslo back, doesn't that imply the dissolution of the Palestinian Authority? And how do you put those two together? The second one is, I'd like to ask you to step back a moment, and because you're assuming that the negotiations are failing, and probably, you know, I tend to agree with you. But there has been a lot of speculation about the fact that at some point Obama might try to put a solution on the table for everybody to discuss. Do you see any a chance that will happen, any possibility that might somehow have positive results?
Others, please.
Well, the U.S. may well veto a Palestinian Arab-sponsored resolution declaring the existence of an independent Palestinian state. If it comes to that, I don't think it will, because both sides have so much to lose with a U.S. veto. What about a more modest initiative in the Security Council that would be much more difficult for the U.S. to veto or perhaps even abstain on? And that would be a resolution reconfirming, reasserting in a dramatic way the applicability of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which 99% of nations and lawyers believe renders settlements illegal under international law. Indeed, that is the U.S. doctrine. At least it's the written doctrine. It has been ignored since 1981, and now we resort to such words as unhelpful, and it undermines trust, and settlements are an element to be negotiated. You've seen the comments of the State Department spokesman in the last few days. Even the president's statement in Indonesia were hardly hard-hitting. Is this an option which might have some potential?
Sorry, I don't. Please.
Those of us who come and go frequently to the area come away with anecdotal impressions. You have scientific data. Two impressions that have come to me from recent visits there. One is that among the Israelis, there's a kind of weariness with the whole process and a feeling that, well, we can live without a peace. Life is pretty good. We've got a thriving economy. Tourism is coming back. So why worry? If we don't have a peace for another 40, 50 years, well, we can manage. Another anecdotal evidence, a Palestinian Bethlehem businessman said to me, "One state, two states, I don't care anymore. All I'm concerned about are two things. I want to have secure possession of my home. I don't want it being confiscated and handed over to an Israeli settlement. That's one thing. That's basic. The other is I want to be able to get in my car and go anywhere in this region to see my relatives, my partners. I want freedom to move throughout this whole area. Those two things, I don't care whether it's one state, two states. I want these freedoms for myself." Is this anecdotal evidence of any pertinence, or is it just bizarre, eccentric views.
One more question. Okay, Khalil.
I agree with you, Marine. Of course, Abu Mazen has not put it in terms of dissolving the PA, giving back Oslo is being framed as Palestinians maintaining state building, but without the obligations of Oslo. He is not stupid or naive. He knows that the Israelis won't accept that. So by implication, I think he's saying, well, we will not dissolve the PA. But if the Israelis, in response to our position that Oslo is not working, they decide to dissolve the PA, let it be. That's, I think, what he's saying. I don't think he is saying we will, as a matter of policy, dissolve the PA. I don't think he can say that. I don't think we will hear these words from him, but I think he basically says it will be the Israelis who will make that decision, and they should know what might be coming. Can the Obama administration put something concrete at the table? Of course they can, but they won't. Why haven't they done it so far? What makes you think they will do it now? These are very important questions, and my own, I don't think there is a scientific answer to that. It's one's judgment on what are the forces that have prevented him from doing it. And in my view, it is not out of the question. And maybe that is what will happen. If it does happen, I think it will be good. As far as the Palestinians are concerned, the reaction of the Palestinians will be, in my view, these are very good ideas. We accept them in principle. We still have problems with this and that and this and that. But this is the list of issues then that we need to negotiate now. The Israelis say the same as we do, and they come up with their own list as well, then maybe this will limit the areas of conflict between the two sides. But it also means that we and the Israelis now agree on everything else. And you can see a sea of agreement and a small number of disagreements. Palestinians will frame this as a major breakthrough in the process, and might even say, look, in 2000 we said Camp David was premature. Now is a good time for Camp David. If the Israelis are willing to say the same thing as Ehud Barak said to the Americans at that time. So it's a process of that basically is two elements. One is ideas at the table, and second one, understanding that then there will be those remaining issues that must be negotiated. It's not blueprint and you have to sign. It's blueprint where the agreement is so wide and the disagreement is so little, and therefore manageable, and therefore a Camp David style might then work. Something along these lines, I think, would be a great idea. When will Washington be ready for that? Is it ready now? And my answer is no. When will it be ready? Maybe after violence erupts, which means after the 2-3 years of Palestinians flirting with all these elements of the alternative strategy and then losing control. But in that case, who will come to Camp David? No one is going to come to Camp David. That is actually your suggestion for a vote on the settlement issue is actually option number one. When Palestinians decide to go to the UN Security Council, before they go, demanding a state on such and such borders with such and such capital and so on, they will go to demand the application of the Fourth Geneva Convention, a reaffirmation of that, and an attempt, therefore, to embarrass the administration. And it will be the Arabs who will go. So the administration will have to confront the Arab world. If this administration wants to improve relations with the Arab and Muslim world, well, the Palestinians want to embarrass the administration in confronting the Arab and Muslim world and make a decision on the issue of settlements. The administration will seek to negotiate this, water it down, find a way to give the Israelis some leg room and so on. But that certainly will be the process if it goes through and if it is agreed and then the Israelis do nothing. Then the next month they will come with that larger issue of something else. It could be a state, could be borders, it could be things Israelis are doing in Jerusalem and so on. This is a process that is gradual but seeks to use international organizations, not just the UN Security Council, but other international forums in all fronts, judicial and certainly on matters of policy and security. So it is a very serious option, absolutely. I agree with you about the perception of the Israelis. And there is no doubt that when both sides feel they don't have to, look, I mean, the Palestinians in 1947 said no to partition. Why? They felt they don't have to. I don't think neither the Palestinian leadership nor the Palestinian public underestimated the costs involved in saying no. They said no because they could say no. The Israeli public isn't going to press for something for as long as they think the status quo can be maintained. And for now, no one is there to remind them. That is, there are, of course, some who talk about the demographics and other things that are might be a long-term threat to Israel, but long-term is theoretical. It's not now. And so part of this alternative strategy is to remind the Israeli public that even if there is no violence to impose costs, there will be other things. And the issue of delegitimation of occupation is certainly one element that goes in their direction, but also the effort to try and impose something via international organization is another way of raising costs for Israelis. For the Palestinian public, I think the Palestinian public is, well, actually, this is the title of our last survey, is confused. It's uncertain as to what will work, what will not work, and where to go. And I think, however, that they are going in the direction that their leadership is going, which is the belief that there must be an alternative strategy. They don't fully agree on all the components of the strategy, but they ultimately want independence. Now, many Palestinians want to just get by and travel and make sure their homes are not taken over by settlers or by land confiscated and so on. The overwhelming majority, when we ask the Palestinians what are the threats they are worried about, the overwhelming majority says that they are worried that they will be hurt by Israelis or land confiscated or home demolished. And this is a major concern for the public.
Okay. One last question, if there is one. Thank you so much, everyone. Khalil, thank you for a very enlightening presentation, if sobering, as I said, but that makes it incumbent among all of us to even try harder. Thank you very much. Please join me in thanking Khalil for this.